Hello, and welcome to the fifth reading of Not So Fast by Tommy Maxwell with Rod Butler. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. We're in this phase of Tommy Maxwell's life in which he is at Dallas Theological Seminary, starting a new career as a minister. After being a star football player at Texas A&M and in the NFL with several teams, including the Baltimore Colts and the Dallas Cowboys. There has been a flag football game between Talbot and Dallas Theological Seminary. DTS won it, and now there's a rematch. The first game, by the way, was rather aggressive. Now we pick up not so fast. Talbot never forgot that game. The next year, they called for a rematch in California with their home crowd. I'm not sure how, but Dr. Walvoord found the money to fly us all to California. And I think we only had one practice when we got there. We did have a be nice talk. Talbot had a pregame dinner where both teams came together. Then, I suppose, in a teasing sort of way, one of their players from the previous year got up to say a few words, which he shouldn't have. And before he spoke, he showed a film clip of the fight the year before, which he shouldn't have. Whatever he said after that, it was sarcastic and smart aleck. It did not set well. So, we had a little team meeting. After the fun of a free ride to California and some relief from studies at seminary, we put on our game faces. We left that night, ready to face them again. The next night, just before the game, we came up with a plan for our 8-man team. Instead of rushing their QB with just the normal 2 down linemen and the 3 linebackers helping on runs and dropping back into zones on passes, with 3 defensive backs deeper, we made another plan. We decided to take a chance by rushing the 2 down linemen and the 3 linebackers on every play. That put more pressure on us defensive backs, and we accepted the challenge. This year, we had some speed and more brains than brawn. And sometimes you just stumble onto an idea that works. The QB had to rush to get plays and passes off, and we pulled his flag before he did, or it would have been a poor pass. We actually intercepted several passes in the first half of the game. I remember one of their players walking down the sideline, both teams on the same side, and telling us that we outsmarted them with our rush. Well, we won, and still can say we are 2-2 in DTS flag football. That was back in 1979. Where are you, Talbot? And really, honestly, I can say that winning those 2 games was as exciting as winning Super Bowl V with the Baltimore Colts back in January of 1970. Well, maybe. Hebrew and loading trucks. In those days, what hit me hard was not a big old lineman slamming into me. What hit me even harder was the fact that all my football money was almost gone. I had to find a job. Not having to work for the first 3 years of seminary was a great blessing, even though Janice worked as a substitute teacher in the public schools and at the Market Center in Dallas. I ended up with a job on the loading docks of a big trucking company. That was not exciting. But I have to confess, it was very humbling. There I was with some tough old men loading freight. They didn't know me or even care to know me. They just wanted me to get those trucks loaded. I worked from 4 p.m. to 12 p.m. on several nights. Mostly it was daytime work. They helped me arrange my schedule around classes, since the owner of the company was a Dallas Seminary donor. I'd been through grinders before, so thank you, Coach Stallings. It definitely was not fun, and between Hebrew and truckloading, I had to find another job. Wait a minute, I thought. I had worked for Texas A&M in development, and Dallas Seminary is a private seminary. They must do some fundraising to stay alive. So I made an appointment to meet a Mr. George Rutenbar. I didn't realize till we met that he had played professional baseball. We hit it off right away, each of us exchanging funny stories. He looked at me and said, "Tommy, with your background, you are exactly what we've been looking for. Can you start work right away? How many hours are you taking this semester?" I filled him in and said I could start tomorrow. I have never been so excited about a job in all my life. I got to work for a wonderful man, graduate of DTS, pro baseball player, and great preacher and Bible teacher. I couldn't wait to tell Janice. Perfect job. Development work was a perfect job for future ministry. I traveled around Dallas and visited donors or potential donors. I met the finest Christian people in the world, and most of them clearly saw the value of Dallas Theological Seminary. Their financial support would train future leaders in the Christian faith. And as a student, I could share firsthand the excellent training and professors I had. Most of the professors also taught Sunday school classes in churches around the Dallas area. So those folks I visited would light up when I talked about their Sunday school teachers from a student perspective. It was a fun job and seemed to fit better with my Greek and Hebrew than loading trucks. It lightened up my load, that's for sure. Although writing this now, I can see what God was doing by putting me on the loading docks. Those dock loaders are as important to Him as any pro athlete. Looking for a pastor. The big day arrived. Graduation. May 1983. I crossed the stage and received my diploma for a THM, Master of Theology, degree. It took me 5 years, 4-year curriculum, to get it since I worked for DTS while a student. I didn't cross a stage at A&M after graduating because I was over in Italy visiting my older sister and her husband in the Navy. So this experience was new and unforgettable. But now what to do? What was next for Not So Fast? I'd been thinking about it, wondering, and then the phone rang. It was Ted Coy. He and his wife Lynn were friends from Bryan, where he graduated from the Texas A&M Veterinary School. Ted had also been a fullback for the University of Texas and played 6 years in the NFL. A little story here. When we met for the first time, I told him I was still mad at him. He got that "what" look. I get that a lot. As I told him what I tell all former fullbacks. I say, "Why don't you guys try to sidestep us little defensive backs so we can tackle you from the side?" "But no, you fullbacks take great pleasure in just running over us poor little defensive backs. What can we do? We try to grab a foot, and then you drag us 10 painful yards, stepping all over us, and worse, while everyone's jumping on us, guess who's at the bottom of that pileup? 800 pounds of linemen heaped on top of us. Me." Back to the story. Sorry, I had to get my frustration with fullbacks off my chest, no pun intended. Ted had heard about me graduating from seminary, and he now had a vet clinic in Georgetown, Texas. He was attending a church that was looking for a pastor and called to see if I was interested. I really had to think about that, since the only reason I went to seminary was to understand the Bible better. But I needed a job, which is not the best reason to be a pastor. Ted wanted to know if I was interested. I wasn't sure if I was interested or not interested, just wasn't sure what to think or do. So Janice and I prayed and decided to visit Georgetown and check it out. Chapter 13. Maxwell in Georgetown. Pastor Tommy. In Georgetown, Janice and I sat down with the elders of Grace Bible Church. The former pastor had also graduated from Dallas Seminary, but decided pastoring was not his calling and went to law school and became an attorney. Well, they interviewed me and about a week later called and offered me the position. I really believe they wanted Janice more than me. The only positions I had been used to were football positions. This was different, a big kind of different. We decided to accept their invitation. And so in August of 1983, we moved to Georgetown with all that a move entails, and we settled into a new life, and for me, a new role. I would be preaching, teaching the Bible to a group of people who had come to church to hear what I had to say. And this was a weekly deal. However, I liked the idea of encouraging folks in the faith. On the other hand, I've never felt comfortable as a public speaker, but once I'm up there and get going, I relax. Truth is, I'm most comfortable sitting at a table with men around me, teaching the Bible, and having fun with it. I had that opportunity while in seminary with a group of businessmen who met at Jack Turpin's tennis facility in Dallas. I learned a lot just watching how Jack would interact with fellow businessmen. I have to smile because it seems the Lord always puts me with a group of real characters. very distinct personalities. I've come to realize that I am somewhat of a different character myself, asked Janice, so we all get along just fine. I never thought I'd be asked to lead a church, but there I was, former pro football player, truck loader, Hebrew student, insurance salesman, and now a pastor. It was exciting to see that what I'd learned I could put into practice, teaching and encouraging others. Training had become opportunity. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. Matthew 28:19. Those 3 years pastoring right after seminary were very interesting and rewarding years. The church really grew, and we made some wonderful friends. However, it came to an end rather unexpectedly. There's not much to tell about this. There was a meeting, there were conversations to discuss the future of the church, and it became clear that the elders' vision and goals for the church did not align with my goals, gifts, and vision for the church. We parted friends, but it was a difficult transition, to put it lightly. Still, as Scripture encourages us to do in difficulties, we trust the God who holds our times in His hand. Psalm 31:15. Well, really, it was just another NSF moment, like the original one, when I stepped into a position and then Coach Madden moved me out of it. My Lord, my Master, my Coach, capital C, would once again point my crazy life in a new direction. Our sovereign God, there's that theological word again, would use my time as a pastor to groom me for the next stage of His calling. Leaving the church in what seemed to be a down moment in my life was really the start of the best part of my life. In fact, being a pastor prepared me to talk to other pastors about Coach's outreach and to be careful when talking to church members interested in joining us. When we interview a potential lay leader, we ask about his church. If he's already involved, we don't want to put more responsibility on his shoulders. If we find someone who qualifies and really has a heart for our ministry, we visit his pastor to bring him into the process. We also invite a person and/or a pastor to look over our doctrinal statement and clearly explain that, as a parachurch organization, we're not interested in draining churches by taking away key leadership that is so important to church life and effectiveness. When the process continues, we go into more detail, explaining how our material makes it easy to facilitate a study. A leader can prep in 1 hour and lead a study in 1 hour and still have a very dynamic ministry time. That insight and church-friendly process was the direct result of my pastoral experience. But back to when the down moment felt like a down moment. Once again, Maxwell needed a job. Now, in Georgetown, where would he find it? These were tough days, and I found myself sinking to the bottom, struggling to look up. During that time, someone told me that reading through the Psalms helped them conquer their depression. I dove into the Psalms, and seriously, it saved my life. God became more real than I could have ever imagined. My time at seminary paled in comparison. I couldn't do it right. Several months later, now in 1986, desperate for work, I interviewed with a manager at our life insurance company, and in turn, got a job selling life insurance, making appointments over the phone. Hadn't done that before. And probably for good reason. Sitting in a typical insurance sales meeting was humbling to say the least. I felt like I was back in Hebrew class. The district manager would look around the room, asking about how many people you called the week before. Uh-oh. Some guys had called 25, some 50, some 100. I sat in an office right next to a fellow who was always calling people, all day long. If you're reading this and you do this for a living, my hat goes off to you. Good job. But I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it right, anyway. One problem was, I enjoyed talking to people instead of moving toward a possible sale. These conversations were always long and in-depth, many times enjoyable. But that was bad, according to my manager. I felt like a lost puppy again, as he scolded me. Tommy, call to make an appointment, not to chit-chat about their pets. You're averaging 5 calls a day. You'll starve to death doing that. What are you doing, man? Well, I did sell a few policies, but if Janice had not been working, we probably would have been starving to death. Into the A&M Hall of Fame. I guess the old telephone has played a big part in my life, and like the call from Madden, a few of those calls turned out to be life changers. I was sitting in my office in downtown Georgetown when I got a call from a representative of the Texas A&M Athletic Department. A smile came to my face as the caller congratulated me on entering the A&M Sports Hall of Fame. That honor had never crossed my mind, and I couldn't quite believe it was happening. A surprised, very blessed kind of emotion came over me. I remember it very clearly. I must have called Janice after hearing the happy news, since she was always my first call. The local paper, the Williamson County Sun, printed an article titled, "Aggie Achiever, Double Duty Earns Tommy Maxwell Texas A&M Hall of Fame Honors." Janice still has the article clipped out and tucked away. I remember telling the reporter, and they printed it, that I almost fell out of my chair when I got the news. That pretty well captured the feeling of the moment. The article covered A&M's victory over Alabama in the 1968 Cotton Bowl. Let me recap. This was a big upset, since Alabama was picked to beat Texas A&M by 20 points. I intercepted a pass that set up our first touchdown and later caught a touchdown pass to put us ahead of Alabama. Since we're talking about it, that play even got mentioned in Beebs and the Bear, published in 2019. The paragraph said, "Aggie safety Tommy Maxwell responded on Alabama's next possession. Maxwell, A&M's two-way marvel, intercepted a Stabler pass and returned it to A&M's 18-yard line. Never thought of myself as a marvel, but that's quite a compliment." Among other things, the Sun sports editor described me as anchoring the Colts' defense, holding the Dallas Cowboys to 13 points in Super Bowl V. I didn't start in that Super Bowl because of an earlier injury, but I was on most of the special teams. Jimmy Duncan had taken my place, and he did a great job. But it wasn't until the A&M Hall of Fame banquet for that year, 1991, which was a formal evening, that I fully realized how thankful I was to have that honor. My mom and dad were there, along with Janice and our daughters, Leslie and Lauren. Makes me smile with that warm feeling again, just thinking about it now. Another call, another Tommy. As time went on, slowly but surely, the wind was dying and my sails were just hanging there, lifeless. On my day off, I sat in my home office and wondered if that wind would ever pick up again. The Psalms always lifted my spirit, but like the psalmist, I asked, "Why are you cast down, O my soul?" Psalm 42:5. Then the silence was broken by, you guessed it, another phone call. The year was 1998. The voice was Tommy Cox, a coach I knew in Austin, Texas. I'd spoken to his football team a couple of times. Excitedly, he said, "Tommy, I sent a letter out to all the coaches in Austin to gauge their interest in starting a Bible study. I've already received calls or notes from 10 of them who want to come." I said, "Well, Tommy, that's super. And I have some good news for you," he continued. "You're teaching it." I heard him laugh, but I heard another voice in my heart saying, "Tommy, I'm not through with you yet." That Bible study came together about 2 weeks later, and there were 15 coaches there, looking at me, ready to go. Eddie Joseph, director of the Coaches Association of Austin, made sure we had coffee and donuts. That's important for those early morning Bible studies. What a great group. We took turns reading through Bible passages and discussed the details, verse by verse. More and more, I began to see how relevant it was to their lives. The Scripture was really coming alive to them. As weeks went on, they shared how much they enjoyed the time together. They were learning, but also making friends with opponents from other schools they competed against. That got my attention. For the first time, I began to understand the heart of great Christian coaches. I couldn't wait to get there, bright and early, every Thursday morning at 6:45 a.m. When we were finishing up for the spring semester, I asked them if they wanted to have some kind of get-together with their wives. They were all in. Then the thought came to me. Jack Turpin, in Dallas, owned E-Bar M, that beautiful retreat center in New Braunfels, Texas. The next week, I asked the coaches if they'd be interested in having something like a marriage retreat there at T-Bar M after the spring semester. They were all for that, too. So I called Jack and told him about our new Bible study and the coaches' desire to get together. I asked him how much it would be to rent T-Bar M for about 15 couples. Jack then hit me with this. Tommy, I had a coach in high school who was like a dad to me. He changed my life. You get those coaches to T-Bar M and don't worry about the cost. I was floored at Jack's generosity, his heart for coaches. But at the same time, I've always believed that dollars show commitment. So I charged them $25, $800 value that first year. And guess what? We had 17 coaching couples at that first retreat. And now we have had over 100 retreats, each averaging 50 couples in 5 different states since that first one in 1993. Today, these retreats cost our ministry, Coaches Outreach, over $30,000 each summer, because we pay about 3/4 of the cost for each couple who comes. Marriages are always strengthened, and many have come to Christ during the conferences. Coaching couples deserve first-class marriage conferences, and we provide that, I'm proud and grateful to say. We were not that organized the first year, and the couples just went with the flow. We decided to pick some older Christian couples and have a sort of question and answer period between coaching husbands, 4 selected men faced all the wives, and wives, 4 selected wives answered questions from all the men. In a separate meeting area, the 4 ladies would answer questions that the men asked. At the same time, in their own meeting area, the 4 men would answer questions that the ladies asked. Brilliant idea, right? Think loud, irritating game buzzer sound. Not so fast, strikes again. The whole thing flopped. Well, to be clear, the ladies got it right. The coaches' wives were articulate, wise, and insightful about their roles. The men just sat there, listened, and never spoke. The 4 men coaches fumbled the ball as the wives hit the coaches with tough questions. It was painful to hear the guys search for different ways to say, I don't know. I remember checking on how it was going. I left the wives' meeting all excited. However, on the way to the other group, one of the wives stopped me, a panicked look on her face. Oh, Tommy, she blurted out, it's a disaster. The wives are all over the poor coaches. The men are sitting there tongue-tied. Some of us older wives are defending the coaches, but what should we do? Like one of the men coaches, I didn't have an answer. We decided to let it blow over, lesson learned. Before the weekend came to an end, everyone actually laughed about the Q&A disaster. And it became obvious to the 4 coaches and 4 wives leading the easy-to-see difference between men and women. The men were oblivious to how the home was run and what the kids were feeling, but the wives had the pulse of every little turn and tension in the home. We learned a lot of lessons from that retreat and the many that followed. Last from the past. About this time in our journey, I was attending an Aggie Club BBQ in Austin. This was 20 years after losing that game to SMU and their amazing QB, Mr. Inez Perez. I walked in and some guys motioned me to come over. They said, guess who that little guy is over there? I had no clue till one of them said, that's Inez Perez. I couldn't believe it. What was he doing at an Aggie function? I went over to introduce myself and ask why he was there. I faced him, putting on the anger. I'm still mad about that game on national TV where you fired off a bunch of passes and beat us. Then smiling, I said, I was in that game. He looked up at me with a half grin and said he was sorry. He explained that he had a good friend who was an Aggie who had invited him, and then he said, I love Aggies. I'm more well known by Aggies for that one game than I am from my 4 years at SMU. It turned out that Inez was a well-respected head coach at Round Rock High School near Georgetown, where he had picked up the name The Little General, great nickname. He told me that he had just received a letter from Coach Tommy Cox in Austin about a Bible study at the Texas High School Coaches Association offices. That was amazing. No coincidences. I told him that Coach Cox had asked me to lead that study. Inez ended up coming to it and loved the interaction with other coaches. The dynamic of this Bible study was very special. These men competed against one another on a weekly basis, but as we studied the Bible together, they each began to grow spiritually and relationally in their callings as coaches. After a few weeks of study, Inez spoke up and said, I took some boys to an FCA conference and I received Jesus as my Savior. That was exciting. I had to know more. Tell us about that, Inez. It was very special. I'd never done that before. My faith in Jesus Christ is my personal Savior. Christ isn't just someone who saves others. He's someone who has saved me. And I don't just hope I'll go to heaven. He promises me I will go to heaven. It was from this Bible study, with other coaches talking about God and their personal relationship, that Inez felt comfortable enough to share his newfound faith and be himself. Inez had a good sense of humor. I always ask one of the coaches to pray after the study. I would make sure they were comfortable with that before I asked them. I asked Inez if he would be comfortable saying a prayer. He said, I guess so. Well, the next week I asked Inez to close in prayer, and he said this, I will pray, but I cannot pray for Coach Cox, who was there that morning. A few coaches smiled, and I asked Inez why he couldn't pray for Coach Cox. Inez said, I am playing Coach Cox's team this Friday, and I do not want God to bless him. We all cracked up, including Coach Cox. God was sure working all those years ago in that first college game versus SMU. That loss to SMU on national TV pointed me to Inez. And God had ordained Inez to be in that coach's study. Can God do that?
Yes, indeed.
Makes life fascinating and provides an underlying sense of security, knowing a sovereign God is in complete control of his creation. All the coaches in that first study in Austin were great coaches, and they were the start of Coaches Outreach. Inez went on to be the athletic director for Lubbock, Texas. Eddie Joseph continued to make sure our meetings always had coffee and donuts. In fact, to this day, they still meet together every Tuesday morning. Things got going. In June 1992, after going through the application process, the Coaches Outreach 501c3 status was official. I wasn't full-time yet, but the ministry was coming together. But I had no idea about the great things God had in store. Another move? On the heels of the experiences of the early coaches, Bible studies, and the first marriage retreat, and with the placement of radio pastor and author Chuck Swindoll as the new president of Dallas Theological Seminary, a new NSF assignment headed my way. The year was 1993. This time, it wasn't a phone call. The DTS director of development and his assistant drove from Dallas to Georgetown to meet with me. We sat down, and in so many words, they invited me to move back to Dallas and once again work in development, fundraising, for the seminary. I talked to Janice. Well, more accurately, Janice had a talk with me. I guess I was pretty insensitive to her feelings when I told her about moving back to Dallas. I kind of dumped it on her, acting like it should happen, just like that. I didn't realize just how many times we had moved. Like 9 times in 10 years of marriage. That was way too many nests my sweet whirly bird had to build. I could tell you how it went, but as I did in telling our dating story, I'd better let Janice tell you, in her words, how that decision played out. Dallas Bound, from Janice Maxwell. I remember it very clearly. Early in May, Lauren had graduated from high school. And Tommy said, I think they're going to ask us to move back to Dallas so I can work at DTS again as part of a team. So we'll need to know what to tell them. I snapped back, that's easy. Tell them no. Tommy came back with, Janice, it's my job. The fact was, I did not want to move back to Dallas, but Chuck Swindoll had just become president of the seminary, and they wanted Tommy's help. But I just didn't want to budge. I knew the Lord wasn't pleased with me, and I didn't care. I was definitely not in the Lord's will with my stubborn, okay, defiant attitude. I remember Tommy saying, well, let's just pray about it. In June, I apologized. Yes, over a month later. I told Tommy I wanted us to do what the Lord wanted, so if that meant moving back to Dallas, I was all in. I said we'd have to sell our house, and with 2 daughters in college, I might need to get a job there, or I stay behind and keep working until I find something there. Soon after, I was at a speech pathology conference in San Antonio. Tommy called and said, well, I've made up my mind on what we're going to do. Okay, what's your decision? We're going back to Dallas. This time I was ready for it. Okay, I said calmly. All right, that's what we'll do. We talked and hung up, and I burst into tears. Back from the conference, Tommy and I began freshening up the house. We put extra furniture in a friend's garage and had an open house Saturday and Sunday. A couple came that weekend and said they definitely wanted to buy our home. Wow. 2 weeks later, I was offered a job in Coppell, not far from Dallas. We sold the house, and another blessing came to us. Friends in the DFW Metroplex needed someone to watch their home while they were away for quite a while. We moved right in. God is so good. Looking back, the only good thing about all those moves was that both Tommy and I could relate to all the moves that coaches and their wives had to make. We could truly empathize, and we never found a couple who had moved as much as we did. So the coaches and couples that we would sometimes counsel could always see that if we were still alive and kicking, they could make it too. Chapter 14. Coaches Outreach Begins. Tommy and Chuck. In September 1993, we found ourselves back in Dallas, Texas. We rented a small house, which, though it worked fine for us, was a difficult adjustment for the girls. New schools, new friends, and really a whole new environment came at a stage in life when you want things around you to stay the same. It had to be tough on them. But like their mom, they were troopers. I never remember them complaining. I'm sure Janice had some talks with them about Dad's calling, which took a while for me to figure out, considering how I bounced from place to place and job to job. We have been blessed by being dependent on the Lord. You can see from reading the scripture that biblical characters made a lot of faith moves. All the moves going one way and then another in my life, NSF, gave me a tested but solid dependence on God's grace and guidance. And I guess a crazy title for this little book. Maybe it will land in the hands of another couple working their way along life's path, with kids and big moves they are questioning. Maybe like a missionary family or a military family or a coaching family. Our walk along life's path has brought me to an active dependence on the Lord. I'll explain that a little bit later. Going back to work for Dallas Seminary was like taking a breath of fresh air, and the head guy was Chuck Swindoll. And get this, there were times, as part of my job, I would go pick him up at the airport. I felt like I was picking up a Hollywood star. People would point at him, and some would actually want his autograph. Chuck had a magic way with people. Anyone who spent 2 minutes with Chuck walked away feeling like his best friend. He would engage people with great questions, and they would share their lives with him. I loved watching that. At a DTS retreat in the summer of 1994, our development staff was having lunch together at a local restaurant. Chuck was with us. A young male waiter walked up to the table and asked, "Excuse me, are you Chuck Swindoll?" Right away, Chuck zeroed in on this young man, asking him questions, getting to know him. The waiter said he was a new believer and listened to Chuck every day driving to work. Chuck just smiled, and we all started leaving while the young man cleared away our dishes. We returned to the bus, and after we all loaded, we started looking for Chuck. He would rather be called Chuck than Dr. Swindoll or Pastor. Someone got off the bus to look for him. Turned out Chuck slipped away to find the owner of the restaurant and asked if he could have a few minutes with this young waiter. I can guarantee you this, that young man will never be the same. And I would love to have heard that conversation and take a peek at that young man's life today. Chuck is a gifted preacher because he loves people like his Savior does. While working for Dallas Seminary, I could go sit in on classes and listen to professors give great lectures on the Bible. I also went to campus chapel services, where I heard some of the best authors and speakers in the country. And then, of course, since it was my job, I made trips to visit donors, sometimes taking me around the country. I traveled all over the place, from nowhere, Ohio, to big cities or small, busy towns. I would find the house, meet the donor, and make new friends. I didn't even have to sell them an insurance policy. But as we spoke, and as I flashed my Super Bowl V ring, I realized that football fans were everywhere. And they loved hearing football stories. We would talk about their lives, their families, and of course, how much DTS appreciated their support. My work for Dallas Seminary never felt like work for me. I just asked questions, cared, and listened. It was almost like pastoring, wasn't it? Reaching out to coaches. Yet another move, this time 1994, to Grapevine, Texas, while I was still working for Dallas Seminary. The girls were both at Texas Tech University. Texas Aggie friends, please forgive me. It turned out to be a great experience for both of them. By this time, I knew these coaches' Bible studies were having a profound effect and were well attended. I saw the value as biblical truth played out in coaches' lives and coaching couples' lives through the marriage retreats, though I didn't quite know how to grow the ministry. As I mentioned, I'd visited with an attorney to start a 501c3 to allow this ministry to have a nonprofit status. That way, people could receive a tax deduction for supporting the work. So support could grow. So the ministry could grow. And there was a location established. My main work was visiting DTS donors around Texas and other states. On occasion, I'd stop by schools at lunchtime to share the ministry of coaches' outreach. The more I met with high school coaches, the more my respect grew for those dedicated men and women. I would travel out to coaches in Dallas, all over Texas, and other states. That was relatively easy. It was not easy to make appointments with high school coaches. They don't work that way. The best thing to do, I found out, was just go to the school and find the coach's office. And if he or she wasn't there, I usually went out to the gym or the field. They were usually out there, somewhere. After a while, I developed a good feel for where they would be. I'd walk up and knock on the door of the head coach. "Hello, coach, do you have 5 minutes?" On a good day, I would hear, "Yeah, come in." I would give a brief introduction and ask if they had ever heard of Coach's Outreach. Sometimes I would have received their name from another coach, and that made it a lot easier to ask for their time and attention. Sometimes it was a cold call, emphasis on the cold. Coaches could be skeptical, uninterested, or just flat out too busy. But coaches are curious people, looking for that winning edge. So they were often curious why I came to see them, or why another coach would have sent me. My spiel. Many times, especially with head coaches, things would grind to a halt after I explained my purpose. They wrapped it up before I could start into it, saying they didn't have time for a Bible study, and neither did their coaches. There was no room in the schedule. My answer to that was this: "Well, coach, time is a very special thing for you and your coaches. However, if just one coach would want a Bible study, we would find an outstanding person from the community to facilitate it. He would be loyal to you and the one coach. We would require this person to visit with you, and if for any reason you didn't like this person, we'd take the hit and find somebody else. And if that didn't work, I'd come out and facilitate the study myself." That would often turn things around, and after months of the one-coach Bible study, more and more coaches would show up. But when the coach was open to hearing it, I'd give my spiel. It usually started with a short history of coaches' outreach. While talking, I'd slide the Super Bowl ring on my finger. I had technique. I would always try to pick a position that showed off the ring. Maybe scratch my chin or rub my eye, ring finger in prominent view. I joke with people that I would even pick my nose with my ring finger. The coach would always see it and ask about it. Sometimes, many times, they already knew what the ring was for. I believe the Lord had it in His plan to use that ring to make sure His truth got to coaches. Then I would present 4 reasons why coaches really liked our Bible study material. 1, you will learn more about the Bible than you could ever imagine. 2, your coaches will grow closer together. 3, your involvement in our studies will make you a better coach. 4, you will have more peace than you've ever experienced during your sports season. They always smiled at the last one, since there is no job that brings as much stress as coaching. I would show them how our studies were fascinating and down-to-earth, and what a lesson looked like. Also, I guaranteed that by doing 4 short 20-minute lessons a week, along with an hour a week in a meeting with other coaches, they would know more about a book in the Bible than anyone in their church. Since all coaches are very competitive, I like that last part best. Starting up Bible studies was my favorite thing to do at Coaches Outreach. The studies were multiplying, and I couldn't have been happier. Especially rewarding was the moment when a coach would send a note or call, sharing how much they were learning and how much they enjoyed the interaction with other coaches from their school or other schools. Quit your day job, Tommy. Another great moment happened in 1996 at the close of a marriage retreat when a good friend, Coach Donnie Snodgrass, handed me a 3-page letter, handwritten on legal-sized paper. There was a detailed, heartfelt outline explaining why Coach's outreach should be, seriously needed to be, a full-time ministry. Donnie felt it was ready to go, given the structure of Bible studies and marriage retreats, and he felt it was time I quit my day job, as they say, to go full-time with the ministry. I knew he put a lot of time and thought into it. It was the perfect game plan for the ministry and spoke right to me, since I was not a coach and really needed to hear and read what a coach thought. Janice was driving us home, so I called my friend Ray Biles, who at the time was the head football coach at the high school where Donnie also coached. I told Ray about Donnie's 3-page letter and asked if Janice and I could come see him and Julie. Ray pretty much gave me the same advice Donnie wrote in the letter. God sovereignly directed these two coaches who both challenged me and had me running some 100s just like Coach Taylor at A&M. The takeaway is this. Coaches started Coaches Outreach, and they coached me up, challenged me, to realize I could be doing a lot more to help coaches than I thought I could. The fog clears. Spring 1997. Things were really rolling now. We still lived in Grapevine, with me still working for Dallas Seminary, still having our summer marriage retreats, and starting up CO Bible studies. Enter the game, Mr. Norm Miller and his company, Interstate Batteries. I'd enjoyed visiting with Norm on a recent trip to Israel with the seminary, so on one of my Meet the Donors rounds, I just dropped in on him to say hello. Sitting in his office, there was small talk, and Norm asked out of the blue, "Tell me about that coaching ministry you started." Funny thing, I found out later that Jack Turpin had mentioned it to Norm. Well, I perked up and started telling him all about it. He was enjoying the stories, laughing, and that always keeps me going. After my hyped-up monologue, Norm turned serious. He gave me a business-like look and said, "Tommy, you work for Dallas Seminary, but your heart is in Coaches Outreach." I melted in my chair. I'd been in a fog for a long time, and suddenly it cleared away. I've not shared this with anyone except Janice, but here it is. I'd been wrestling with where my heart was, but always dismissed it. Here's why. I'd been thinking, praying, really stressing about going full-time with Coaches Outreach, but I had to keep working because our funds were very low, keeping the girls in college. And though it was tempting, I was not going to ask seminary donors about supporting Coaches Outreach while working for Dallas Seminary. Back to the Interstate Batteries office. I was stunned by Mr. Miller's comment. I couldn't speak. I just looked at him. And he looked at me. Well, really, he looked past my face and right into my soul. I gave in. I told Norm about my struggle. And like a true businessman, he got right down to the finances. He asked me how much I needed a month to make it. I fumbled around with some numbers. He pulled out his checkbook and wrote a check. He handed it to me and explained, "Tommy, you can use this to help coaches attend your next conference, or you can use it as a monthly salary so you can spend all your time with Coaches Outreach." I'll never forget that moment, but there were more moments on the way. Soon afterward, I had lunch with a buddy from seminary, Andy Wildman, or Andrew Wildman, as I call him. Andy pastored Grace Bible Church in Dallas. He knew about my involvement with coaches and the Bible studies, and he told me, a year before I would meet Norm, to get after those coaches. Quit screwing around. He was short and stocky and talked more like a coach than a pastor. At that lunch, Andy told me about his dysfunctional Bible study group and one of the men in the group, all-pro lineman John Nyland of the Dallas Cowboys. Andy challenged me to go talk to John. He said he had already told John about me and Coaches Outreach. I was a little nervous for some reason, but John and I had a great visit. He asked me what my biggest concern was about starting Coaches Outreach. Still getting used to opening up about stuff like this, I hesitated, then told him it was making my house payments. Without missing a beat, he offered to cover any house payment I couldn't make. Again, the Lord worked through one of his boys, cowboys, to keep me going forward with Coaches Outreach. My faith was really growing. During that year, 1997, I did it. I left Dallas Theological Seminary and went full-time with Coach's Outreach. In the big picture of things, the Lord worked through several of his boys in the formation of Coach's Outreach. My good friend Scott Henderson and our mutual friend Tommy Nelson, pastor of Denton Bible Church, were two of those boys, and a big part of the early formation of the ministry. I'll pass the ball to Scott here and let him tell you a few of his stories, this one going back to 1998 in Denton, Texas. Gospel Blimps from Scott Henderson. During one Sunday evening service, Pastor Tommy Nelson took spiritual measurements of the members of Denton Bible Church, calling us gospel blimps if we attended DBC for a year and did not exercise our faith. The impact was so great on me that I can quote Pastor Nelson, "If you have been attending Denton Bible Church for over a year, and you just sit there soaking up the gospel, biblical truths, etc., and not exercising your faith, you are a gospel blimp." Gospel blimp is a term that describes a person who floats along, keeping their distance, enjoying the ride, but not really engaging with people or purpose. Although there were probably over 1,000 people at the service, I felt the Holy Spirit had singled me out. So I invited Tommy Nelson to a chicken fried steak lunch to discuss it. Across the table, I confessed that I was worse than a gospel blimp, attending DBC for over 2 years as tapes and CDs accumulated, and Pastor Tommy said that he would prayerfully consider a ministry for me. 2 weeks later, Tommy called and wanted to introduce me to a guy named Tommy Maxwell, founder of a ministry called Coach's Outreach. Note the timing. Tommy Maxwell had reached out to Tommy Nelson to discuss his vision for the ministry, probably stressing that he needed lay leaders outside the coaching profession to facilitate the Bible studies. As they say, you can't make this stuff up. God was at work in the small details and the large scope of building his kingdom. I met with Tommy Maxwell, and I was impressed. At this introductory meeting, he gave an overview of the vision he had for the ministry. Then we met again. The second and third meetings were strictly to verify my fundamental beliefs. Soon after, Tommy invited me to be a lay leader in the North Texas regions of Denton County. I accepted. I have affectionately identified the training for the lay leader as the Junction Boys Bible Boot Camp, playing off Tommy Maxwell's A&M roots. Starting with one, then growing to two or three of us, we would meet at Tommy's home in Grapevine, Texas, for a day of one-on-one biblically-based linebacker drills designed to meet the spiritual objectives of ministering to coaches. By the way, these were some of the greatest moments in establishing my own personal foundation, training me to be prepared for the CO Bible studies. At this particular time, about 15 coaches from several high schools in the Denton area expressed interest in a Coach's Outreach Bible study. We had one lay leader, the first one, me, and I believe at the first meeting we had coaches from 6 area schools. We gathered together at the Radisson Hotel. This is when the ministry stumbled onto a problem. It's not uncommon for coaches to move every year, and we found that coaches would move to a new location and want a Coach's Outreach Bible study at their new school. This began to happen at an exponentially high rate. Quickly, the need for lay leaders outpaced the ministry's ability to train them. A good thing, but a pressing need. And, as is also common, it led to a breakthrough. Coach's Outreach would need to establish a regional recruitment and training program to meet the lay leader needs for all these coaches. God met that need, raising up lay leaders to fulfill the expansion of the Bible studies, today many hundreds of them across multiple states. As the ministry expanded, a phenomenon took place. God raised up retired coaches from across various regions of the state of Texas to volunteer in promoting the Coaches Outreach Bible studies to area high schools. Another breakthrough. And because these coaches were very well known, respected, and recognized within the community, the Bible studies grew even more. Presently, at Coaches Outreach, recognizing God's hand in this area, the ministry has established field reps as contractual positions with individuals who love the Lord and this ministry. The results of the Field Rep program have successfully advanced the gospel and Bible studies to regions within a growing number of states throughout the country. I appreciate Tommy Maxwell letting me have a place here to share this jazzercise history of Coach's Outreach from my point of view. Along with fellow board members Dan Mitchell, Tommy Teague, Jack Simmons, and more, we join to celebrate the outstanding work God has engineered in the formation of this ministry. And of course, Pastor Tommy Nelson's earliest endorsements and continuing support over the years have been a highlight of God's hand in the outward and upward growth of this ministry. Back to me, Tommy Maxwell. I guess I just realized we've got a lot of Tommies involved here. Me, Tommy Cox, Tommy Nelson, and Tommy Teague. Well, it's a good name, isn't it? Anyway, my friend Tommy Cox will tell you lots of stories from the growing years of Coach's Outreach. Tommy Cox calls this his fork in the road story. Take it, Tommy. Fork in the road from Tommy Cox. We lost a game we should have won. Blaming the kids for the loss, I lit into them on the bus ride home. But when I saw the hurt in their eyes, I knew right away I was wrong. I tossed and turned all night, recalling what I'd said and how I'd said it. I was devastated. I called them together before practice the next day and told them how ashamed I was for my actions. And humbled, I asked for their forgiveness. That was a game changer for me, a proverbial fork in the road. I realized how selfish and destructive my coaching style was, and how it affected my players, both in their performance and in their lives. I knew why God called me to coach, but I was not getting it done. I prayed countless times for His power to remain faithful to what He called me to do. I started accepting more responsibility when we had bad practices and when we played poorly on Friday night. I knew I needed to prepare better, teach more thoroughly, encourage and motivate with enthusiasm, make it fun, and most important, love them, win or lose. This event had a major impact on my relationship with kids, really, for the rest of my entire coaching career. It taught me the importance of forming lasting friendships with them, friendships that would continue long after their playing days. But it made a difference in the players' performance, too. Get this, we won our last three games and qualified for the state playoffs. Like all coaches, I love to win, and I believe God wants us to excel wherever He calls us. But I don't think He's that concerned about how many games we win or lose. He gave us this platform so we could love kids and lead them to Jesus for His glory, not ours. To that end, I hope to hear Him say to me one day, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." Chapter 15. More Coaches, More Outreach. The Sign on the Building. A while back, someone asked me, "Tommy Maxwell, how did you start Coaches Outreach?" I answered that real quick. I didn't. God did. I couldn't have imagined what God had in store, but He knew all along and had it prepared beforehand. I was walking along doing the good work of trying to start Coaches Bible studies. I knew the numbers of these Bible studies were growing, and I knew more and more coaches were attending, but I had no idea that in the years to come, God would build a nationwide ministry. So let me get back to the story of Coaches Outreach, picking it up in 1998. Not yet full-time with the ministry, though I was committed to that goal, I worked out of my home and began the search for an official office. We needed a place in Dallas, basically with a room and a phone. My friend Joe Furstenberg finally met that need. He provided an office with a phone at his construction business in Dallas. He even allowed us to put up a CO sign on the exterior of his building. Somehow, the sign on the building stamped Coaches Outreach as a real place. Janice and I stood there, looking at it, very grateful. I was, of course, excited. We brought on Robert Orion and Mark Wyatt to help with organizing the addition of more Bible studies. I spent at least 4 days a week just meeting coaches in Texas, traveling farther east, talking about the studies as far as North Carolina. I remember taking a trip through Ohio and Idaho. I saw Amish families riding down the road in horse-drawn wagons with cars passing by. Although they chose a simplified life, I'd heard they engaged in all kinds of sports. I would have spread the ministry to them as well, but didn't meet any Amish coaches. To this day, I love meeting and interacting with coaches involved at all levels of sports. My mother once told me I should have chosen coaching over playing, and I don't know, maybe she was right. Then again, although players take a lot of hard knocks, coaches live in the real battle of the sports world, especially high school coaches. I remember a significant conversation with Coach Ken Hatfield, who played for Arkansas and was later head coach for Rice University in Houston. I gave Ken a call, and he invited me to come on by. As I shared with him some of the basics of doing Bible studies for coaches, the subject of college coaches compared to junior and senior high school coaches came up. Coach Hatfield definitely had thoughts about that. "Tommy," he said, "junior and senior high school coaches look up to college coaches. That's just the way it is. But I look up to them. They're in the real battle, dealing with parents, hormones, teaching classes, and very low pay for very long hours of work. I always, always encourage my players who are thinking about coaching someday to consider high school coaching, since they will have a longer time to have a real influence in their players' lives." Learning on the way. Some things you learn on the way. As Scott said, we learned that coaches' outreach functioned best utilizing laymen, those not in full-time ministry, to facilitate our Bible studies. I say facilitate because CO designs the lessons to be self-taught, so our lay leaders, LLs, simply facilitate a discussion with the coaches. But to find the right lay leader, we've learned to rely heavily on the grace of God. We have an application form with questions designed to help us see the heart of the man who would lead the study. Although not necessary, many of our LLs have been in sports and already have a high respect for coaches. As flexible as we are regarding their experience in sports, we do have some strong boundaries. For example, we do not allow fathers to be lay leaders at the school where their child is involved in sports. It's pretty obvious why, since favoritism could come into play. In a similar way, since we are a non-denominational parachurch ministry, we do not allow ministers to be lay leaders. However, doctrinally, we would likely line up with any conservative, Bible-believing, evangelical denomination. Across the years, great friendships have developed between lay leaders and coaches. Coaches discover a trusted local friendship outside of coaching, which is valuable and really somewhat rare for them. Through God's grace, we have many hundreds of men across the country serving as lay leaders. There's no way to find that many great Christian men who love their coaches and are equipped to lead the studies without God's complete blessing. But we've learned to be careful and cautious along the way. Early on, there was an incident that taught us a lesson. A father, who was also a lay leader, confronted a coach for not playing his son more. We didn't realize this father had a son on the team. It can happen, but it can be harmful to a ministry like ours. So I knew this incident had to be settled right away. I called the father and told him we couldn't have a lay leader angry at a coach. And I told him that we would have to find another person to serve as lay leader. He became angry, but I had to stick to my decision. I called the head coach he confronted and asked for a meeting. The first thing I said, not finding another way to say it, was that I fired the lay leader. The coach smiled, but I didn't. I was upset, so I tried to cool off and apologize to the coach. The coach was very gracious. I asked him to trust us to find another lay leader. He gave me the okay, and I can report that we've had a study at that same school for 16 years now. God tests us sometimes, and like the slippery places on the old football fields, we might lose our footing here and there, but eventually we learn the lesson and move on. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of Not So Fast by Tommy Maxwell with Rod Butler. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.